I first started going to Tokyo about 8 years ago. I worked there in 1989, not in Tokyo, but I worked in Japan in Fukuoka, which is the largest city on Kyushu, which is the largest of the four major islands, the one most south. And I really fell in love with the quality of the food and the people then. And in the past few years, I've had the opportunity to go and travel and eat and learn a little bit more about it. I'm fascinated by some fundamental tenets of Japanese cuisine that I think I can apply in my own food.
I've never met a chef who didn't fall in love with Japan. David Kinch, chef owner of Manresa in Los Gatos, is no exception.
I think that they present food very simply. I love the idea that they pick vessels that food's served in almost specifically for the particular dish, to the point where a lot of high-end places use, you know, artisans to craft just particular dishes. And most of all, I can't believe how much flavor they get out of the food with such a minimal use of fat, which I find extraordinary. You know, some of the greatest food eating experiences I've ever had in my life are at a couple places there. You know, one of the reasons I go back is because I dream of these places and going back and eating again. They never disappoint. There's a sushi place or two that get better and better every time I go and help me understand food a lot because, you know, it is just rice and fish, right? That's all it is. It's just rice, they say. But, you know, there is a lot going on. And I think the more you learn about it, the more you eat it, especially at the top, you understand the importance of, you know, why God's in the details.
Today on the show, we look to Japan for inspiration. We find out how one American chef has transformed her pantry with just one Japanese ingredient. Plus, how a Jewish kid from Long Island ended up with a ramen restaurant in Tokyo. And of course, tuna. The endless appetite for tuna. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. This week's market report comes not from Santa Monica, but from 5,000 miles away. There's produce there, Haas avocados from Mexico and bell peppers from California, but there's also fresh wasabi root, barrels of miso and fish, an absolutely astonishing amount of fish. I'm talking about Tsukiji, the largest wholesale fish and seafood market in the world, which is set to move from the center of Tokyo to a distant location before the 2020 Olympics. Chef David Kent shares this postcard from the market.
Yeah, the first time I visited Tsukiji, I can't imagine anybody not being overwhelmed by the experience. You know, the size, just the scope, the size, the quality of everything, especially in the inner market. You know, you visit the fish market, and I remember as a cook just being, you know, how they use ice. They use ice completely different than how we do. They don't, you know, fish doesn't touch ice. You know, it touches water that has ice in it. And I remember as a young cook, you know, you're always icing down fish. You know, change the white, you know, there's water there. Get rid of the water, you know, just ice it down. And ice burns, just like heat burns, ice burns too. And ice has hard edges, and it bruises flesh through skin. And, you know, they make slurry. It makes perfect sense when you think about it. You know, you put fish in its natural environment. They put it in water, and then they put ice in the water like it's a drink. And the fish, you know, the pressure of the water is the same as the water that they swim in their own natural environment. And it's not bruised, and it's the same temperature. And it's simple, and it's brilliant. And, you know, it affects how we store all our products at the restaurant now. You know, the tuna, you know, the tuna auction's fun to see. You know, it's fun to see once or twice. But the market is so big, and there's so much things going on. And the outer market, which is not moving, by the way, and that's, you know, with repeated visits, that's where you can really dig in deep, you know, and they sell everything. Rubber boots, you know, to walk around the fish market, all kinds of pickles, anything related to food regarding Japan or even in Western food is there. You're going to find it. The vegetable market is always overlooked. People always talk about the fish market, but there's a huge, amazing vegetable market there where things come into, and it's really pretty astonishing. There's great little restaurants, and it's just a great meeting place. It's a really extraordinary experience. And when I'm there, I go every morning. You know, it's a great way to deal with your jet lag is to be there at 5:30 in the morning.
Over the years, Tsukiji has indeed become the antidote to travelers' jet lag. But Beth Reiber, author of Frommer's Japan and Frommer's Tokyo, remembers Tsukiji before it was in the guidebook and well before Anthony Bourdain filmed it for No Reservations.
30 years ago, hardly any tourists were at the Tsukiji market, and I didn't see many over the years, but now it's become so popular that visitors are loving Tsukiji to death. And so they limit the number of tourists who can see the tuna markets on a first-come, first-served basis.
Reiber, who also serves as the Visit Japan ambassador, is quick to say that the tuna auction is not the only attraction of Tsukiji. A sushi breakfast, unusual as that may sound, is also a draw for many visitors.
Inside the market area, the compound, are these barracks, and they're just tiny holes in the wall. I mean, enough for like 12 diners. They open with the market like 4 or 5 in the morning, and usually they go until about 11 or noon. And they serve sushi right there that they've purchased. So it's about the freshest sushi you can eat. And they usually have set meals or the chef's choice. And so you just tell them how much you want to spend and what you may not want to eat, and they'll go from there.
Tucked in with the stalls serving sushi, you'll find tiny storefronts serving coffee, bowls of ramen, or Japanese omelets. But it's tuna that remains king at Tsukiji. Walking through the stalls of the inner market, you're left with little sense that there's a conservation movement to preserve bluefin.
Tuna is everywhere at Tsukiji. It's probably the largest specialty amongst the wholesalers who work there. It's the largest trade group. And certainly it's the product that not only in popular imagination defines the marketplace, but also in terms of the global fishing industry, Tsukiji is where tuna goes. But in terms of getting a sense of the conservation or the preservation of tuna, Tsukiji is not the place that you're going to get a strong sense of that.
Ted Bester knows Tsukiji. He's the director of the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies at Harvard, where he also teaches anthropology. He's also the author of Tsukiji, the fish market at the center of the world. I asked him to give us a snapshot of the market from the point of view of the vendors that work there.
The market really starts, 2 a.m. in the morning, perhaps. Trucks are rolling in from all over the country. They're lining up in the parking lot. The drivers are trying to get some sleep. And about 2 a.m. or so, the cargoes get unloaded. They get distributed across 15 or 20 different auction sites. Then around between 5:30 and 6 in the morning, the auctions start. And there are separate auctions for tuna. There are separate auctions for shrimp. There are separate auctions for sea urchin. So depending on what your trade is, the day starts there. But in the popular imagination, it's always tuna.
Can you give us a sense of how big it is now? How many people are selling there? Like maybe if there's stalls, how many stalls are there?
Well, we need to back up a bit because in order to understand the flow, you have to understand that the tuna comes to 5 auction houses that sell tuna at auction every morning. And each of those 5 large wholesale houses has its own network of suppliers and fishermen who deal with it directly. At the auctions, the tuna are sold to maybe these days around 300 or so buyers. And those buyers are the people who operate the stalls in the marketplace. So at any given day, there may be 200 to possibly 300 people bidding on the tuna.
And is there a greater imprimatur from some sellers than from others?
Yeah, reputation matters. Reputation matters in terms of the producers. Some fishing companies, some fishing enterprises around the world have a particularly good reputation for producing fine grade tuna. Some locations, some ports in the world are regarded as producing better tuna. When it gets to the auction house, the auction houses they each have their clientele, they each have their reputations, but it's not really a matter of pride or special status to have bought a tuna at this auction or that auction. But what then does matter, and this matters a great deal, is the reputation of the stall that is selling. Some wholesale stalls make a very special point of only dealing with top-end sushi chefs. Others only deal with French restaurants. Some places deal more with retail fishmongers in Tokyo. And depending on who your clientele is, you can charge more or less for a particular tuna. So if you're in the food business, who you buy your tuna from at Tsukiji says a lot about what you think of your own position in the food chain, if you will.
Now, when we're talking about Tsukiji, so far the only fish we've mentioned is tuna. How much of the total marketplace is made up of other fish, not just tuna?
I'd have to look up the statistics for you, but there are something like 450 varieties of fish that are officially cataloged in the market statistics. I would, just off the top of my head, say that probably about 20% of the net sales at Tsukiji are tuna, and 80% is other kinds of seafood products.
Wow. Now, I understand that there is going to be a move, that Tsukiji is actually going to be moved by the government to a different site.
That is correct. According to current planning, in 2016, a new marketplace will be opened up in a place called Toyosu, which is a landfill island in the upper reaches of Tokyo Bay. It's perhaps as the crow flies, or maybe the seagull flies, a couple of kilometers east of the present-day location. But it's an area that has not previously been connected to the rest of Tokyo. So that it's not only the creation of the new marketplace, but also the creation of a new transportation infrastructure that will enable people to get back and forth.
And why are they doing this? I would imagine that the area where the market is located is a center of commerce that goes beyond just the fish.
Well, why are they doing this is a good question. And there are lots of people connected to the market and others in Tokyo who question the reasoning. But the nominal rationale is that Tsukiji is located in the middle of the downtown business district of Tokyo. It's a land-intensive use that involves a lot of truck traffic and so forth every day. And having it essentially in the middle of the financial heart of the city doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. It's not where you would put a market if you were thinking about it today. So the idea is to move it out of the center of the city, to rebuild it as a modern, efficient marketplace, and coincidentally to free up land in the center of Tokyo that can be used for the 2020 Olympic Games. There also is the fact that, as you say, there's a whole neighborhood around Tsukiji that has built up over the last almost 100 years of shops that deal in restaurant goods, spices, cutlery, disposable chopsticks, and so forth, that depend on the market for their trade, but they're not going to be relocated. And so that creates a lot of uncertainty, a lot of anxiety about the local neighborhood, what's going to happen to that part of town.
What about the issue at the location of the new fish market, that the land was a former petrochemical plant?
This is a big issue. It's one that has been explored extensively by opponents of the move. The site that is being used for the new marketplace was previously owned by the Tokyo Gas Corporation, which used it as some kind of a petrochemical storage facility. The land itself has been confirmed even by government investigations to carry carcinogenic chemicals to a level far beyond what is permitted under Japanese regulations. So the government has had to commit itself to a massive cleanup of the site. And it would be like putting a marketplace in a Superfund site. And the question is whether that cleanup will be really effective. The other problem that it arises is that the island is a landfill island. And landfill is subject to liquefaction, which is what happens when an earthquake happens, that landfill sort of turns into ooze. But at this point, it's frankly a moot point. Since the announcement of the 2020 Olympics, the government has essentially given itself a green light to go ahead and say, okay, this is going to happen. we have no other choice. We promised the International Olympic Commission that this space will be available for the International Press Center.
Wow, so interesting. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Ted Bester is the director of the Reischauer Institute of Japanese Studies at Harvard, where he teaches anthropology. He's also the author of Tsukiji, The Fish Market at the Center of the World. We have a photo essay of the Tsukiji Market that you can see on our blog, the Good Food blog. So check it out at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, two Japanese pantry ingredients that will change your life. I'm not kidding. Stay with us.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. If you follow food-obsessed circles in L.A., you will have likely heard of Sonoka Sakai, a woman who's making great strides at deepening Americans' understanding and appreciation for Japanese food and culture. Her soba-making workshops have become quite the coveted ticket, and grain geeks are all abuzz about the buckwheat she's planting with local farmers. But today, she's here to talk about dashi, that deceptively simple broth at the base of most Japanese dishes. For me, it's almost magical how a liquid made so quickly and with only a couple of ingredients gives an entire food culture its backbone and with zero fat. Hi.
Hi.
It's so great having you here.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
Dashi seems so incredibly simple, yet it's so primary in the Japanese kitchen. What is it akin to in Western cooking?
I would say that in Western cooking, it's all about starting with olive oil. So, I mean, you know, if you're going to cook something like spaghetti or even, you know, make a salad, you take that bottle of olive oil out. Well, I take my dashi out.
So dashi ends up being in hundreds and hundreds of dishes that we never, that aren't liquidy, that aren't necessarily a soup.
Right. It could be in a sauce. It's actually like a hidden ingredient. It plays a supporting role, like in a film. It doesn't come out in the front, but it's essential.
So what are the ingredients that make dashi?
Dashi is actually the generic word for stock. So it could actually be a number of things, but the most popular one in Japan used by Japanese cooks are bonito flakes. And this is dried fish flakes that have been shaven with a plane, and you could actually buy the pre-shaven flakes. And the other popular ingredient is kombu seaweed.
So let's talk about the bonito. What is the Japanese word for this type of fish that is then shaved?
The bonito is actually a skipjack bonito. They also use some other types of tuna, but that's the most popular one. And it's called katsuo.
When we say that it's fish that's shaved, they're not shaving a fresh fish.
No, they're shaving a dried fish. It looks like a hard block of wood that's actually been smoked, cooked and smoked and dried.
It's been completely transformed.
Yes. I mean, the skipjack tuna is about 5 to 10 pounds. They shrink to about 1/6 of its size when it's turned into blocks of katsuobushi.
And we're used to having bonito flakes maybe adorning the top of a bowl of noodles or an order of sushi. And I'm sure a lot of us never really realize just the amount of artisanship that goes into that one ingredient.
Right. It's quite a lot of labor. I actually visited a factory in Yaesu, Shizuoka, and watched how much work it takes to clean the fish, boil the fish, dry the fish. And it's not just smoking it once, but smoking it over several days. And then you could actually take it even further and inoculate it with a beneficial mold to dry it even further. That's another form of art. It's called karebushi. So you have different kinds of bonito flakes.
When I took the soba class with you and we were talking about dashi, and you mentioned that people used to have a plane that they shaved the katsuo on, I went online to look it up, and they themselves, these beautiful little coffin-like boxes.
Coffin.
with a little wood plane attached.
Right.
Is that what you use, or do you buy the packaged kind?
In the old days, when I was growing up, my grandmother used that. She shaved enough katsuobushi every day to make miso soup. And we took turns learning how to shave it. But then with modernization, we learned that you could buy packaged bonito flakes that are just as fresh. But actually, it's never as good as the freshly shaven ones. But so I rely on the ones that are already shaven, because that's all you could get right now.
So we don't have to feel bad about using those.
No, but you have to be selective, though, because when you go to a Japanese market, you will see all kinds of bonito flakes packaged. You want to get the ones with the long, wide curls. They almost have a shine to them.
To me, they remind me of really beautiful wood shavings, long wood curls.
Yes. So the ones that are in the smaller packages are more for putting as for like furikake, for toppings, like for spinach or for over maybe your omelet or on your rice. And those could be as small as cherry blossom petals. But the bigger packages are used for making the dashi stock. And you want to be generous with it. For each cup of dashi stock I make, I use a handful, which is a loose cup of bonito flakes.
Okay, so we have the katsuo, we have the bonito flakes. What are the other essential ingredients for making the dashi?
It could be layers of different ingredients, but the second most popular combination is kombu seaweed. And I would add a couple dried shiitake mushrooms to that for another layer of umami.
What does kombu look like in the package once we buy it?
Some are folded. They're just these long pieces, and it could be curly, it could be flat, and it has a thin film, a white film that looks like mold, but that's not mold, and it's not dirt. And that's the umami. That's the essence of flavor. So so don't try to wipe that off when you use it.
Okay, so take us through the process of making it.
Okay, so what you start is a pot of water. I use filtered water, and I put the kombu in there. And sometimes you could also, if you want to, you could make incisions with scissors on the sides, because through those incisions, it will release more flavor.
Wow.
So you just chop, 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 you know, just cut the sides. But I get kind of lazy, so I'll just break it and stick it into the pot and then bring it to almost a boil. You pluck it out of the simmering water just before it reaches that boiling point. And then you lower the heat and add the katsuobushi. And then you turn the heat down and don't stir it too much. Just give it one stir with chopsticks or with a fork, and just let it steep.
Like a tea.
Like a tea, right.
Is there a tiny little flame underneath it, or do we turn it off?
Some people will turn it off, some chefs. There's all kinds of theories. My mother or grandmother, they would simmer it for about 3 or 5 minutes. I usually just turn it off. And then all you have to do is basically strain it through a paper-lined, like a colander or fine strainer. And there you have your fragrant primary dashi.
So what are some other ways that we might not think about using dashi that you use it for all the time?
I use it for salad dressings. And the simplest one is it's oilless, primary dashi, rich dashi with a little soy sauce. And I let my, let's see, boiled spinach, blanched spinach, just marinate in that dashi. And it's so flavorful with maybe a little sprinkle of roasted sesame seeds. Very refreshing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Sonoko Sakai is a food writer, author, and cooking instructor. We've got a recipe for her dashi and a soup with broccoli and wakame on the blog. Plus, we've got outtakes from our conversation. It's all at kcrw.com/goodfood. For me, one of the most inspiring things about Japanese cuisine is that nothing's wasted. Often, just one rich substance is the base for a group of umami-rich pantry items. Miso, soy sauce, rice vinegar, sake, amazake, soju, mirin. Japanese food is unthinkable without these marquee flavor makers. And they all come back to koji, the magic mother substance. But what is it exactly, and how does it work in the kitchen? Courtney Burns is co-chef with Nick Bala at Bar Tartine in San Francisco, where they make really, really good food. She's here to explain what exactly that mysterious koji is.
Koji is inoculated rice in its purest form, but it's the base for all of those things you mentioned originally. It is the base for miso and sake and amazake. It's what creates all of those flavors that, you know, we've grown to love. It's a way for us to layer more flavor into the food that we make, and it does amazing things. It also helps to gently cure things. It seasons them. It sweetens them. So there's all these things that you can do with inoculated rice, and it doesn't have to just be rice. It shouldn't limit it just to that, because you can inoculate any grain that has sugar in it.
And are you inoculating it with a particular bacteria or fungus?
Yeah, we inoculate with this Aspergillus spore. It's Aspergillus zorii. I'd probably say it wrong. I always do. But that spore itself is what's responsible for aiding that inoculation that happens.
Could you describe what the process of making koji is and then what it looks like compared to the other forms it takes?
For example, today we're using white rice for what we're doing. That's the flavor that we're going for, or other times we do brown rice or barley or things like this. And we take that and we wash it pretty intensely to pull out some of those starches that are present on the rice. Then we soak it. There's all sorts of debate on how long you need to soak your rice for koji. We do anywhere from 3 hours to overnight. And then once it's soaked and strained, we then take it and steam it. So instead of cooking rice like you would in your rice cooker or in a pot, we do it over boiling water in an actual steamer basket so that we're not introducing any more liquid into the rice. Too much liquid in the rice does not allow the inoculation process to really happen in the way that we would want it to. So once we steam it and it's tender, we take it and we cool it down almost a little bit under body temperature. And then from there, we inoculate with the spores. So we actually buy spores. We've done in the past where we collect our own spores. We make like a mother, basically. For now, it's just easier for us to buy the spores. And then we mix them with a little bit of rice flour so that they can get evenly all over the rice. And then we put them in a temperature and humidity-controlled environment for anywhere from 48 to 72 hours. Stirring them as we go, monitoring temperature as we go. And what happens is the rice starts to get like a white film on it. It almost looks like a blanket of snow, like fresh powdered snow. And it encapsulates the rice kernels and turns them really sweet, turns all that starch into sugar.
Okay, so now you've gone through all of this and your koji rice is done.
Mm-hmm.
Then what do you do? Do you then turn that into blocks? How do you keep that so you can use it for future projects?
So we do a few different things with it. One, we'll then put it into a higher power dehydrator at a low temperature just to dry it out, which stabilizes it completely. We've also frozen it. We take a lot of it and make shio koji.
So let's take this opportunity now to talk about shio koji, which just blew my mind. It looks like a beige slurry.
It's amazing stuff. When we first started working with it, our minds were blown as well by the flavors that you can get out of it. What we do is we take our fresh koji and we weigh it, and then we mix 10% salt by weight, add water to it till it's a consistency of, say, oatmeal, and then allow it to sit at room temperature for about 7 to 10 days to do kind of a secondary fermentation process. From there, it's usable just as is. That's probably what you got. It probably still had some rice grains in it.
Yeah, and I should say that you can buy it in Japanese grocery stores.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will use it just as, like you said, a dollop onto your rice or mixed in with your eggs or anything. And it amplifies all of these flavors of sweet and sour and salt. And it's brilliant. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing stuff. We use it in more of a pureed form. So we take like the jar you got and we would put that in the blender.
And then I understand that you're doing some really fascinating things with it. So tell me what you do.
We marinate meats with it and fish. which starts to gently cure it and starts to break it down in a similar way that, you know, salting things ahead of time does. So let's say if we had a chicken, which we were doing a koji roasted chicken for a while. So we take the whole chicken and we just rub it. Like imagine you were putting, you know, a marinade on it and that's it. I mean, you don't really need all of that much. And it just, it penetrates pretty quickly because of the high salt content. But also there's sugars involved as well and all of these different things that are, you know, playing on each other.
How long do you let it marinate?
We like ours at least 24 hours. It does a couple things. We let it kind of go uncovered and air dry a little bit because it gives us a really beautiful crispy skin, at least on the chicken.
Have you used it to make ice cream?
Yes, we have. There's actually a couple fun, sweet things that we've done with it. It is white rice koji. The other ones too, but specifically the white rice koji is wildly sweet. So once it's inoculated, when you eat it, It's like eating sugar in the best of ways with all of these other things going on. We just cook it like oatmeal, and then we've poured amazake, which we make with the koji as well, which is just a non-alcoholic kind of short ferment, short inoculation with water. So it's basically a sweetened beverage. And we take that and pour it over the top just with some fruit, and you end up with like a just wildly naturally sweet rice porridge. And then we've made ice cream with it, which is absolutely delicious.
Well, but there's no, but you're not adding any white sugar to it.
We've added some invert sugar in way of honey to the ice cream so that we can get the texture that we want, but we're able to pull out most of the sugar. We have a dessert on the menu right now that's a steamed parsnip cake. We've done it with celery root. Right now it's parsnip. It's kind of in the style of like a steamed mochi cake, but we've been able to pull all of the sugar completely out of that by using koji rice flour. So as I said, we sometimes dehydrate the rice. We can take it all the way dry and then blend it into a rice flour. And that's what's setting this parsnip cake. So there's absolutely no sugar in the dessert, even though it comes off as very sweet when you're eating it.
Wow. You know, and all I've been doing with it is sort of correcting the balance in my soups.
That's perfect.
Wow, it has been just a pleasure talking to you, and my mind is already percolating with all the other conversations we can have. Thank you so much, Courtney.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to be here.
That was Courtney Burns. She is a co-chef along with Nick Bala at Bar Tartine in San Francisco. If you've never been, boy, you must go. If Courtney piqued your interest in koji or cooking with Shio Koji, we have some outtakes and some recipes on the Good Food blog for you. And all you bread bakers out there should check out the koji sourdough in Chad Robertson's new Tartine No. 3 book. There is boundless inspiration there. Coming up, there are 8,000 ramen shops in Tokyo alone. Yet, a Jewish guy from Long Island thought it would be a good idea to open another one. Find out how he managed to stand out in a city full of noodles. Next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I've always been fascinated by cross-cultural food love. Take Ivan Orkin, for example. The man put on the Japanese culture like a suit that fits so well, he's been completely accepted in Tokyo as a master of ramen. His restaurants, Ivan Ramen, showcase his obsessive bowl of noodles and broth. And the book, Ivan Ramen, breaks down the bowl into all its parts to let you share in his painstaking process. Hi, Ivan.
Hey, how are you?
I'm so happy to get to talk to you. I am such a fan. Maybe you could share with us how you fell in love with Japanese culture.
Well, I mean, it's an awfully long story, but, you know, I think to make it short, I was a teenage kid and my buddy called me up and told me that the new Japanese restaurant in town was hiring, and he just had gotten a job as the dishwasher and they needed one more. And I went down there and I got the job. And to my surprise, you know, I was hungry all the time because I was 15, and they fed me, and I was just in love with the food, and even more importantly, I think I was in love with the people. And it just started this kind of lifelong passion for Japanese culture and language. And, you know, I'm a Japanophile turned chef, not the other way around. And I think some of the people that want to tell my story, they wish I was a chef who decided to come to Japan to open a ramen shop. But that's not really the story.
So you ended up going back and forth and back and forth quite a bit between the East Coast and Japan. And in one of your stays on the East Coast, you went to culinary school.
I moved to Japan after college. I lived there for a number of years and really didn't know what to do with myself. You know, I taught English, which wasn't all that interesting to me, and couldn't really find my groove. And so I left feeling kind of bad and kind of had my tail between my legs. And then I came to the realization that, you know, cooking was something I had sort of been holding off for a long time. And it was time to sort of dive in and become a cook.
And once you did that and circumstances changed and you found yourself in Japan again, did you start working in Japanese kitchens?
No. I was just talking to someone about this. It's funny that, you know, I think my story is organic in the sense that I never really have a plan. I still don't really. I never do. And I just sort of do things when it occurs to me. And for a long time, sort of the Japanese thing and the cooking thing were separate. I mean, I loved Japan and I lived in my own little Japanese created world. And then I cooked. And it really just came about, the ramen shop idea came about because I was taking care of the kids and, you know, driving my wife crazy. So, you know, we sort of decided it was time for me to get a job. And the ramen shop idea came up.
Had you been a ramen head as an eater?
I was, you know what? When I moved back to the United States in 1990, I didn't live in Japan regularly again for 13 years. And you could eat almost any kind of Japanese food, right? You could get yakitori, you could have delicious sushi, you could get all different kinds of things. But ramen was really the only thing you couldn't get. And it started to sort of fester with me. I would dream about it and obsess about it. And so that when I moved back in 2003, I was eating it all the time. And my wife kind of joined me in my obsession. And we were eating it 3, 4, 5 times a week, driving all over Tokyo, searching out these little tiny shops.
And was a lot of what you were eating mediocre?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Ramen has 8,000 shops, you know. There's 8,000 ramen shops just in Tokyo. And ramen really is just a fast food. You know, a lot of the people use ingredients that are mass-produced. They're not really made with that much love or with any artisanal flair. The whole ramen boom really is still pretty new in Japan. It's not like in the 80s there was brilliant ramen all over the place. There was much more cultish, you know, 25, 30 years ago.
It's so fascinating. So you fixed, it was actually then the mediocrity that sort of gave you the spark of the idea, right?
You know what? I found enough places that I really liked. I was intrigued at how they made it. Because like in the West, we're taught to take fat out. And, you know, and in ramen making, you put fat in and you put these really rich seasonings in. And I couldn't understand how it was made. And I would kind of lean over the counter and I would watch the guys and it was never really clear what it was they were doing. And I think half of the whole Ivan Ramen thing was just this fabulous challenge of seeing if I could do it. I mean, it didn't cost that much money and my wife had a great job and I was like in this enviable position where I didn't necessarily have to succeed like to eat. And so I had a little slack to sort of figure it out. And I loved the challenge. It was really fun. You know, I would go to, you know, I make all my own noodles, and which was very uncommon at the time. And it's still, you know, a very small percentage of ramen shops make their own noodles in-house. And really the reason was I would go to these ramen shops and I would eat the ramen and I would turn to my wife and I'd say, the soup is so delicious, but why are the noodles so terrible? And I just couldn't sort of get it as a chef. I'd be like, why would you have a place called a noodle shop without delicious noodles? And that sort of started me on the whole path of learning how to make noodles.
When you really started gathering information, because you knew you had this in the back of your mind you were going to open, how did you figure out all the components you needed? Did you apprentice yourself to somebody?
No, I made everything up. I mean, I went to the six-day ramen class. The guy who makes my noodle machine, he started this little ramen school, so it was a six-day class. I mean, I wouldn't recommend going there if you know nothing about cooking. I don't know what it would do for you. But I think if you know how to cook and you have an inkling of what you might want. Remember, I had eaten many hundreds of bowls of ramen, so I sort of had a clear idea of the flavors I wanted to create. And, you know, you're a chef, you know, it's like you can see food in your mind. You can see flavors in your mind. Sometimes you have to figure out how to get that out of your head. That was more my challenge, is how do I get the notion I have in my mind onto a plate?
When you first opened, you were in kind of a quieter area of Tokyo, I understand.
It still is.
And you were waiting for people to discover you. At that point, there were two guys who were pretty important to you. One was a man who's made it his life's work to eat every bowl of ramen that opens. Is it in Japan or just in Tokyo?
In Japan. Yeah, he's
I don't even know what to say about that kind of desire.
He says he eats three bowls a day.
The day that he made your bowl one of his three was a pretty important day for you then.
Oh, yeah, it was wild, really. And it's funny because, you know, my friend who helped me open the restaurant, he's really savvy and he, like, knows everything that's going on. And anytime anybody walked in, he always knew who it was. And this guy walked in, and this was like, I think, our third day. And I was, you know, dripping with sweat, and clearly I'm super nervous. And, you know, I'm making ramen in Tokyo for the first time and selling it, you know. And he walked in, and the guy ate the ramen, and then he stood up and he started asking me all these questions. And I couldn't catch what he was saying. And my Japanese is quite good, but I just, you know, with all the stuff that was going on, I sort of said, huh? And he just sort of said whatever and kind of walked out. And then my friend's like, oh, that was, you know, Osaki-san. And I was like, God, great. That's just great. But he ended up really liking it. I asked him, I said, you know, what'd you think? And he said, you know, when I was on my way over here, I was already composing your bad review in my head. And he said, but when he came in, the kitchen was really clean and you were, you know, clearly, you know, working really hard and you made your own noodles and whatever. And he really liked it. It took a while after that to really get popular, but at least it gave people permission to come and try it with a little bit more of a serious eye, I think.
Thank you so much, Ivan.
Thank you. What a thrill to be on your show.
Ivan Orkin owns two ramen shops in Tokyo. In November, he opened his first stateside outpost in Hell's Kitchen, and New Yorkers are anxiously awaiting his 50-seat Ivan Ramen to open soon on the Lower East Side. His book, Ivan Ramen, is a must. If you follow the ramen craze here in LA, you know that the most prized broths rely on a particular ingredient, animal fat, whether it's a stock simmered with pork bones or a spoonful of schmaltz just before serving. It's hard to imagine a time before Japan embraced meat. But this time did exist, and here to tell us about it are Tadashi Ono and Harris Salat. They explore the comfort food of Japan in their latest book, Japanese Soul Cooking, where a single bite of food in public changed an entire country's appetite. Hi, gentlemen.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello, how are you?
So let's talk about that single bite of meat in public that changed everything. What was it?
Well, it was the Japanese emperor in the late 19th century. About 20 years before, Japan, which was closed to the world for couple of hundred years, people from Japan couldn't leave the country. It was really isolated in an isolated part of the world. Suddenly, they were compelled to open their doors for trade by America and Western powers. And the Westerners came pouring into Japan with their, you know, coming into trade, but also they brought their own eating habits and you know, different foods that weren't common in Japan, including meat, which wasn't eaten for at least commonly for over 1,000 years by Buddhist edict. I think from what we've read and researched, the emperor was very impressed by the size of the people, the Westerners coming in, and he had ambitions to make Japan a powerful country. And eating meat was very taboo. And then in 1872, he actually ate meat in public, which sent shockwaves through the country and changed the way people eat.
Wow, so Amazing. So before this big moment, what kind of foods did the country rely on to eat?
Well, washoku, right? Tadashi, like right. Traditional cooking.
Traditional, regional, more fish-oriented or vegetable, mountain veggie, you know, farm veggie, like shojin ryori, which is like Buddha kind of vegetarian cooking.
And then a lot of fermented seasoning, right. Miso, soy sauce.
Yes, exactly.
Now, what about curry? I remember the first time I saw curry on a Japanese menu and I ordered it and I was just sort of shocked because it's so completely different.
You know, In fact, I I had the same experience because, you know, curry, I think of South Asia, of India. And what curry, it was actually a British import, and it was curry powder that came to Japan. And it's something that became adapted originally by the Japanese military, that the Navy and the Army learned how to make curry from their British counterparts. In the Army, everybody takes turns cooking, so people started to really get really start to love curry, and it started to kind of spread around Japan. But how is curry different? I think one of the things that I think about with Japanese food that it's more about balance than impact. So instead of, you know, being super hot or super spicy, it's kind of spicy. There's also a little sweetness to it. There's sometimes some fruit. There are a lot of different flavors within a curry that make it really appealing.
Okay, so now let's move to a food that I have to say is beloved here in Los Angeles. And that would be tonkatsu.
Oh.
You just heard Tadashi swoon. Evan, you're not here in New York, but I see a few tears. Kind of his eyes are getting watery.
So describe what it is.
Well, it's a deep-fried pork with a breadcrumb. It's like most common meat dish in a home cooking. Period, because it's something, you know, meaty, something, you know, fry, really excite the kids too. You know, it's like when I hear tonkatsu is a tonight dinner, it was like, wow, it's like a feast. So it's it was a really exciting dinner for us. You know?
Now, was the pork flat like a chop or was it chunky like a carnita?
It's one flattened pieces, and you know, you cut after you fry, so it's maybe like half inch thick. It's like a steak kind of a size.
You know, what's cool about it is that it's coated in panko crumbs, and panko crumbs were apparently invented also in the military years ago. It's a way of creating breadcrumbs that are super crispy and they don't absorb a lot of oil. So they kind of maintain their crispiness when you deep fry stuff in panko. And so when you come out, it's not like eating like a corn dog or something that's really heavy. It's deep fried, but still like it doesn't taste that oily or you know, overwhelming. And the panko has such a great crunch on it. So it's really, that's part of what makes it so delightful.
So is the pork first put in flour and then egg wash and then panko?
Yes, correct.
So the flour helps the egg adhere, and then the egg helps the panko adhere.
Yeah, they all stick together.
And then what kind of fat would you use to fry it in?
They used to use a pork fat.
Then everybody died.
That's the supposed to be the best way to fry tonkatsu. It gets really crispy.
Ah, must be great.
But, you know, nowadays it's in a health, you know, everybody concerned about health issues. So we use, like, vegetable oils. Yeah.
Is there a particular color that is the platonic ideal of...
That's what they call fox, right?
Yeah,
golden fox, yeah.
Yeah, the color of the fox.
Yeah.
And it actually works. Like if you're frying this thing and you look at it and it starts to remind you of a fox, you're pretty much in good shape. It's done.
You guys have whet my appetite so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us, Evan.
That was Tadashi Ono and Harris Salat. Their book is Japanese Soul Cooking. Find a recipe for that katsu pork that Tadashi was swooning over on our blog. Coming up, a taste of Japan here in L.A. Jonathan Gold's in the studio next with the review of the new Sushi Zo in downtown L.A.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Jonathan Gold's in the studio with me to talk about a recent addition to LA's sushi landscape. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and today he's taking us to the new branch of Sushi Zo at 4th and Main in downtown LA.
Zo is probably the most polarizing sushi place in Los Angeles.
Why?
Because it is breathtakingly expensive, because it is only omakase. You can't speak up and say what you want. And because of the style of service, it's $150, right? We've got to say this up front, $150, $145 prefix, bam. You get to choose what sake you want. You get to say whether you have tea. That's kind of it.
So the sake is included in that?
The sake is not included in that. It's, I mean, you're going to spend a couple hundred bucks a person. So you're resigned to that. And there's a style in really high-end sushi bars where it's almost an educational process as much as it is an eating experience, where the sushi chef is telling you stories about the fish or where it came from or why it's special that they're having it this week. At Sushi Zo, there is none of that really. I mean, you sit down, you're handed a hot towel, you order your drink, and you're served like your first course, which will inevitably be a Kumamoto oyster with a little bit of ponzu. It's nice. That goes away. Then you get three slices, count them, of tuna, really soft, usually big eye. I'm glad they don't use bluefin, which nobody should eat. And after that, you'll get a baby abalone with it in its shell with a little bit of ponzu. And a tiny dish of squid cut into noodles and tossed with uni and a little truffle salt, which sounds a little weird, but it's one bite. It's delicious. Then you get sushi, one after the other, after the other, after the other. It's usually 25 things, sometimes 20, sometimes 30, but it doesn't vary that much. It's like you eat one, another one gets put on. If you're in the sushi bar when it's busy, you will see the sushi chef making 10 pieces of sushi at the same time of the same fish and then sort of like dealing them out like cards.
It's so interesting because it seems like the reason one would go to a very high-end omakase place is because there's a very particular point of view that the sushi master wants to present to you.
Well, I think there is a particular point of view. And I'd always thought there was a particular LA sushi style. And I mean LA sushi style as opposed to sort of the, Matsuhisa, Katsuya, New Wave sushi. But the regular sushi, I think, is done probably in its most extreme way here, that LA-style sushi, starting it in Ozawa and at places like Hiko, at Zo, there's probably half a dozen places in town, the rice is warm and the rice here is almost hot, that it will be loosely packed and here it's extremely loosely packed. It will be somewhat highly seasoned and here it's definitely more highly seasoned than average. And it's a tiny little marble of rice that's pressed into the thing. So you pick it up and you eat it in one motion. And it's like the rice is almost more of a condiment than it is not just a point of the dish, but even like a part of the dish.
So it's like flipped.
Yes.
Where really traditionally it's all about the rice and the fish is the condiment.
Right. I mean, sushi, of course, arose as a way of preserving fish by putting it on vinegared rice, and that sort of pressed sushi that you see some places is the original sushi. But it's about the marriage of the rice and the fish. And here the rice has almost become vestigial. Most sushi bars you go to, I mean, other than the specific style of sushi bar, you go to and you get the little dish of soy and then you get the wasabi, which will be, you know, the vile stuff out of a tube in bad restaurants and the, you know, divine freshly grated wasabi in good sushi restaurants. But here you're not given soy sauce at all. Everything's seasoned, so there'll be a squeeze of yuzu and a sprinkling of salt. There'll be a splash of ponzu. There'll be a little bit of soy. There'll be something fermented. But you have absolutely no control over it. So in a way, it is this aesthetic because you're getting fish after fish after fish after fish seasoned exactly the way he wants it, exactly the size he wants it, and exactly the rhythm that he wants to surf it at. So you do experience the meal as sort of like this long, continuous series of waves instead of as this piece of sushi and this piece of sushi.
And so who is the he? Who is the man behind this?
The chef who owns both the restaurants is Kaizo Seki, who I'd always sort of imagined worked at Nozawa because his style is not un-Nozawa-like, but who in fact was at Hiko, the inexpensive but really, really high-quality place on Sawtell before he started the restaurant.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. Very interesting.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, about the new branch of Sushizo in downtown LA. Get a text with the restaurant's name, address, and phone number by texting GOODFOOD to 69866. That's GOODFOOD to 69866. Plus, find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations on GoodFood's restaurant map. It's on the GoodFood blog. If you missed any part of today's show, don't fret. You can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. I want to thank the Good Food crew. That's Jillian, Laurel, Sarah, Caroline, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.